Hello, I'm Sebastian Gagnon d'Orval. This is number 0266, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Older, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0266. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Kiki Ebson, daughter of legendary actor Buddy Ebson. She has a new jazz album out that honors his memory called Scarecrow Sessions.
I found a bunch of artifacts in a box, which were scripts from his days in New York, from the Broadway shows that he did, like Yokel Boy, and from the MGM musicals. I found his original script to Born to Dance and some of the Broadway melodies that he was involved with. And I found his songbook from The Wizard of Oz with his name on it as the Scarecrow. And I was just blown away because it was such a piece of history in my hands. I thought, I really need to do this record. I need to do it for him. I think I'm at a mature place in my life musically where I can really do the song stuff.
Dan Melka is the creator of PowerTogether.com, a new online social network for kids and teens to encourage them to do good deeds.
I think that the key problem was that kids were being thrown all this new technology at once, and because of this digital era we live in today, there was nothing that was actually prepping them or guiding them and educating them on becoming socially responsible digital citizens. So we tried to create something that will compile everything into one, but most importantly, creating something which is our number one goal is the privacy, safety of these kids on social media.
Dr. Carlisle Smith is the author of Heads Up Dreaming.
You have a dream about someone you haven't seen for, years even. It's unusual enough that you actually kind of remember your dream, and then later in the day, something happens. You actually run into this person, they phone, there's some kind of connection, and it's kind of weird. And you go, oh my God, I had a dream about this guy. Because it doesn't happen too often, people sort of go, maybe I must have been thinking about him. They kind of rationalize it away because you're not supposed to be able to defy time like that. That's what I call a heads up dream. That's an example of a really simple one.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0266, was Sebastien Gagnon d'Orval. He's a freelance cameraman at Global Montreal, the other place that I work. And thank you very much, Sebastien, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Now, this is a story that initially happened a couple of years ago, but the court case is now coming to light. A marathon masturbator... Yes, you don't hear that sentence very often, do you? A marathon masturbator in China died after he donated his seed to a sperm bank four times in just 10 days. Xiang Gang was found slumped over and unconscious in a private booth at the Wuhan University facility in Hubei province after staff noticed he hadn't come out in 2 hours. When the medics broke down the door, they discovered the 23-year-old lying on the floor and immediately tried to resuscitate him. Doctors ultimately pronounced him dead of a heart attack. He was only 23. Wow. Gang's family took the sperm bank to court because his relatives felt the clinic was responsible for his 2012 death. They demanded to be paid $648,545 in compensation and claimed that the clinic had forced him to sign up. Now, they also said the clinic pressured the young man into making frequent donations and alleged the medical staff, did not properly handle the situation once they discovered him unconscious. But a court has now ruled that his demise was entirely his own fault because he was capable of making his own decisions, including going on a masturbatory frenzy. Gang started studying to become a doctor at Wuhan in 2010. He joined the sperm bank program a year later and was known to be a regular advocate of the facility, sometimes even encouraging others to make their own donations. Okay. Interesting story. Yeah. But I think we're burying the lead here. I mean, after reading all that information and talking about this poor gentleman's death, the one thing that sticks in my mind is a country with over a billion people feels it needs sperm banks. Meanwhile, the UK's Barnett Council got aggressive in August against a landlord in North London who had defied an earlier order to stop offering a too small apartment for residential rental. Landlord Yakov Maroum said tenants were still eager for the room even though the entryway required most people to drop to all fours since it was less than 28 inches high and therefore a fire code violation, by the way. Council officers checked on the earlier order against Yakov and found a couple still residing there paying the equivalent of $685 a month. Wow. You know, this sounds like an old joke, a place so small that even the mice are hunchback. But seriously, how do you get furniture into a place like that? Yeah. Anyway, a car full of teenagers crashed in Idaho after authorities say one of the passengers lit the driver's armpit hair on fire with a lighter. All five young people in the Ford Bronco were hurt in the crash and had to receive medical attention. Authorities say two of the passengers were thrown from the vehicle, but none of the five suffered life-threatening injuries. The Ada County Sheriff's Office said the rollover occurred after a 16-year-old boy was goofing off in the front seat and lit 18-year-old Tristan Myers' armpit hair on fire while Myers was driving the vehicle. Deputies cited Myers for inattentive driving, while the 16-year-old was cited for interfering with the driver's safety. Okay, wait a minute. I understand charging the idiot with a lighter, but seriously, how attentive can a driver be with a flaming armpit? Isn't that charge a tad excessive? I'm just asking. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Malaysian man who implanted 10 metal ball bearings in his penis to bolster his sexual abilities. Shall I repeat that? Because I'm sure you didn't hear it right the first time. Let me repeat that. A Malaysian man who implanted 10 metal ball bearings in his penis to bolster his sexual abilities had to have the balls, that's the ball-bearing ones I'm talking about now, surgically removed when they started to rust. The man, identified as Ramley, who is 44 years old, said he implanted the balls himself, ouch, after a friend told him he had successfully used the method to increase his sexual stamina. Well, it's not like you can get someone to do it for you, right? I mean, that has to be a really good friend. Anyway, my private parts swelled up for 3 days, but I endured the pain and didn't see a doctor, Ramley said of his self-surgery. He said the wound healed and he found the method was effective in helping him satisfy his sexual partners, but a few months later he discovered he was unable to get an erection. Ramley said a doctor recommended that he have the metal balls removed or risk irreversible impotence. He said the balls were removed surgically and he discovered the trouble had come from them rusting inside his body. Yeah. You know, how can I put this? I enjoy sex as much as the next person, but if someone said to me that the only way to increase sexual stamina was to implant 10 metal ball bearings into my penis, I think my answer would be, no thank you, I think I'm done. Yeah. That's it. It's over. Let's just move on. Start gardening or something. I don't know. Anyway, let's get to our next guest, or first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Kiki Ebsen is a singer-songwriter and the youngest child of the legendary actor Buddy Ebsen, who is probably best remembered as Jed Clampett in The Beverly Hillbillies and the title character in Barnaby Jones. But if you remember an interview from many years ago that I was lucky enough to do with Buddy when his book came out called The Other Side of Oz, then you know that he was much more than those two signature characters. We'll talk to Kiki about her album in just a moment, but first, here's a little taste of what it has to offer. Here's If I Only Had a Brain.
I could while away the hours conferring with the flowers, salting with the rain, and my head I'd be were scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching. If I only had a brain, I'd unravel any riddle for any end of fiddle.
What you've just heard is a little bit of If I Only Had a Brain, which is a track from a new album by Kiki Epson. It's an album of jazz standards that's dedicated to her dad, Buddy Epson. It's called Scarecrow Sessions, a title that comes from the fact that her father was originally cast in that role for The Wizard of Oz. Kiki joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Kiki.
Hi there.
And just to clarify things, I know there are a lot of people who may have read your dad's book, or which was called The Other Side of Oz, or heard the stories about him being the Tin Woodsman. He was originally cast as a scarecrow, then bumped to the Tin Woodsman, then got sick from the makeup, correct?
Yeah, that's right. That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as the way the story goes, which actually you can read in his book, is that, Louis B. Mayer's kind of right-hand man sort of whispered in his ear and said, hey, I have it on good authority. You're going to be the scarecrow. And he's like, this is great. And then there was another actor that came on the set with his agent, Ray Bolger, who definitely took the role. But they gave him the Tin Woodsman.
Yeah. So flash forward to this album coming out. This obviously had to be a labor of love for you. What made you do this album?
Well, I had been thinking about it for a few years. My dad always wanted me to sing jazz, and he loved the standards. And, of course, I'm the youngest of, six children, and there's a bit of an age gap there. So I kind of thought my parents, like most kids, that their music was kind of old, and when I was growing up and when I was first getting into music, I wanted to be a rock and roll singer. So I really didn't listen to his requests to sing jazz, and I didn't have an ear for the standards when I was younger. So over the years, I've had a really nice career in music, and I've put out 5 records, and I'm getting to this place where I really appreciate, all kinds of music, and I just absolutely adore jazz, and my style ended up being jazzy and kind of jazzy pop anyway when I do my original songs. So, after my dad transitioned about 10 years ago, I found a bunch of artifacts in a box, maybe just a few years ago, which were scripts from his days in New York, from the Broadway shows that he did, like Yokel Boy, and from the MGM musicals. I found his original script to Born to Dance and some of the Broadway melodies that he was involved with, and I found his songbook from The Wizard of Oz with his name on it as the Scarecrow, and I was just blown away because it was such a piece of history in my hands. I thought, I really need to do this record. I need to do it for him. I think I'm at a mature place in my life musically that where I can really do the songs justice. I just didn't want to be some singer that put out a jazz standard CD. It had to be very heartfelt for me because I'm a writer. I'm a songwriter. So all my songs, all my music has a connection. I just can't do anything without feeling truly involved in it. And I felt my dad's his spirit and his energy surrounding me and helping me and guiding me through the process. So we just did it. I was swirled up in the energy of the moment in the beginning of the year. We raised the funds through Kickstarter. I got a great producer who I worked with. He's a sax player who worked with me, with Christopher Cross, who I played in his band for a while. And we got these great musicians, John Patitucci and Clint DeGannon and Chuck Loeb, all these wonderful New York players. And we did it in like 2 months. I mean, we really literally did the tracking in 2 days.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a whirlwind.
Did you, I know this kind of sounds new agey, but did you kind of feel your dad's presence?
Oh, totally, totally. I actually, on the last, you know, several years, maybe the last 6 years, I've been doing a song of his called Missing You that I found right back around the time my dad transitioned. And I, even though the song wasn't quite stylistically what I would do, I took it and rearranged it and kind of made it, you know, put it in a way that I felt really comfortable with. And the lyrics are so beautiful and the melody is fantastic. And I would sing it and start to feel him around me and feel really connected, like, wow, we're really on the same page here. So that type of energy just kept coming sort of to the surface, you know, as we got closer to realizing this project. And everything fell into place. I mean, everything. I went to New York. I had no idea what it would be like to record there. I'm a Southern California girl, so, you know, and I have, you know, so many studios here in Los Angeles. Why go to New York? Why put yourself in an unfamiliar place? It's because my dad's career started there. I wanted to, like, walk down the steps and the streets that he grew up, you know, like that he started his career on. I wanted to go by the theaters and find his old apartment and, you know, the places he used to eat and just get a whole East Coast vibe, you know, infusion into this project of mine. So basically I wanted to be out of my comfort zone and I wanted to feel as vulnerable as he might have felt, you know, on his first steps off the train in New York City.
Did you have the opportunity, because, I mean, your father passed away back in 2003. Did you have the opportunity to talk to people who had worked with your dad with the idea that you were putting this album out or who have heard this album since you put it out?
You know, not really. It happened so fast. And frankly, a lot of my dad's contemporaries are not with us anymore. So there are a few people left in the business that have, you know, are you know, finding it through the social networking and whatnot. But a lot of the people that I knew have really transitioned. So it's kind of nice. I'm meeting maybe a decade or two younger generation, younger than him, that maybe have worked on the studios, worked as cameramen and writers and whatnot, that are just starting to hear it. But I really think the best is yet to come. I think there's a lot of promotion going on right now, and people are just starting to hear it. And I think as that happens, I'm going to get a lot more people coming out of the woodwork that have worked with him, actually, and that are really going to appreciate this.
Now, as you said, this was your first jazz album. Because it's something, a type of music, too, that your dad also liked, does that put added pressure on you?
Oh, sure. I mean, the whole thing was pressure for me. I mean, my style is sort of jazzy, folky pop, but as a writer, I just consider my music very original. So in taking on a jazz standard, great American songbook project, there's so many fantastic artists out there that do this stuff in their sleep. You know, for me to just decide, well, I'm going to go to New York, I'm going to work with the best musicians I can find that ended up being great friends, you know, of mine now, I thought was really cheeky. You know, like, why are you just going to walk into this genre? So I felt a lot of pressure that, what if it sucks? You know, what if it doesn't sound good? And what if I really, you know, end up making a fool of myself? But I had tremendous confidence in my producer, who is a David Mann, who is an amazing saxophonist and just incredible human being. And we'd worked together, like I said, for the last 4 years with Christopher Cross. So I knew him and I knew his integrity, but I honestly had no idea how talented he would be with me and the band and the studio. So I just would say to him, can I do this? Am I going to be able to do this? He says, oh, yeah, you're going to be great. It sounds great. And the band was wonderful to me and so generous with me in the studio. And I just sang. I didn't play. I'm a piano player, but I wanted to just sing and be a singer and let the band surround me and sing live. And most of the tracks we got are live.
Well, the album sounds great. You have a couple of songs on the album that come from The Wizard of Oz. You have If I Only Had a Brain and Over the Rainbow. You have some other great standards on there, like Missing You, Moon River. T for Two, which I think I actually heard your dad do on a variety show when I was a kid once.
Right.
So
that's it.
You've got a lot of great songs on there. Again, like you say, you discovered some of this from his material. Was it tough to whittle down to the 12 songs that you have? Because I'm sure there were more than 12.
You know, it wasn't as hard as I thought. I mean, there are a lot of tunes. And, like, these aren't necessarily tunes he sang. You know, like, Easy to Love is just from that MGM musical. And, you know, I wanted to choose songs that he also just loved, like Laura was his favorite song. I knew that I knew kind of the core group of tunes that I was going to do. So after I did it, I started to remember other songs that would be really great. So sequel, you know, that'll be part two. But no, these kind of really made a lot of sense when we lined it all up and we listed them. We definitely went, yeah, these are the ones.
How do folks get the album?
You can go to my website, KikiEbson.com. You can go to iTunes, and you can go to Amazon.com. So all the major online distributors, and even in some stores too.
Excellent. Kiki, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program. We had your dad on the show many, many years ago, and he was a joy and a thrill to talk to. So I'm glad I've been able to connect with you as well.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Singer-songwriter Kiki Ebson. Again, the album is called Scarecrow Sessions. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0266, and you'll find links to Kiki's website, plus links to Amazon.com where you can order the album directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Viewer discretion is advised. But then again, why are you staring at a radio program?
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about a new social media website that encourages kids to do good deeds. Plus, we'll talk about dreams with the author of Heads Up Dreaming. And of course, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way, all here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. But we have a lot more Stuff File news to get to, starting right now. A British dog who had a pair of panties surgically removed from his stomach failed to learn his lesson and is still snacking on thongs. Kay Banks of Rotherham, England, said Brian, a 4-year-old Samoyed, is notorious in her home for stealing her underwear and those of her daughter, Charlotte, and he is especially fond of black and bright pink thongs made of silk and lace. Banks said Brian was previously able to pass underwear on his own without incident. I'm assuming they were thrown out. Please tell me they were thrown out. But he recently underwent a 2-hour emergency operation at the vet when a pair of pilfered panties clogged his intestines. Banks said Brian returned from his four-day stay at the hospital and almost immediately consumed another thong. Veterinarians were able to make Brian regurgitate the most recent pair of unmentionables without surgery. Banks said, "We just couldn't believe that after an operation and 4 days at the vets, he'd come home and does it again. From now on, all underwear is put straight into the washing machine. He's a lovely dog, but he's into everything." According to veterinarian Tony Duffy, he said, "Brian is a remarkable canine. It never fails to amaze me what dogs will swallow, but swallowing three thongs in such a short space of time must beat them all," Duffy said. Okay. You know, I'm thinking, if you believe in reincarnation, it makes you wonder who he was in his last life or who he'll be in his next. Yeah. Anyway, a New York homeless man says he avoids having to sleep on the pavement by getting women to take him home with them. Joe, who was 26, a Boston native, said that his mother threw him out when she found his drug stash, and he can make up to $150 a day panhandling on streets in Manhattan. But he spends most of the money that he makes on keeping up his appearances as well as on drugs and booze. Joe said he goes home with women 3 to 4 nights a week. "I do homelessness a little differently," Joe said. "I might sleep on cardboard 2 or 3 nights a week, but I literally wake up every single day and do whatever the bleep I want." He said there's no real secret to his seduction technique. "It's not like I forgot how to get women just because I became homeless," he said. Oh, jeez. Oh, my God. Now, I've seen a short film on this guy. He's no gift to women. He's quite crude, rude, and socially unrefined. And I'm not saying that because he's homeless. I suspect that if he lived in a mansion, he'd still be a jerk. But as for the women he picks up, I mean, just how low does your self-esteem have to be? Dads, are you listening out there? Please hug your daughters. Please. Okay, when her 10-year-old granddaughter didn't come home from a barbecue in Hudson, Florida, a woman called police to report the girl missing. The girl's mother, 29-year-old Bobby Joe Butcher, had dropped her daughter off, so a Pasco County Sheriff's deputy called Butcher at work to see if she knew about the missing girl. He says Butcher responded, "I have to get on stage." She's a dancer at the Calendar Girls Strip Club. And she then hung up on him. The child was found safe later that night. Butcher was arrested for resisting an officer and obstruction, even though she told deputies that she hadn't hung up, but rather took another call. Oh yes, because that call would have been much more important than the one about her missing daughter. Wow. Not exactly mother of the year. As for the daughter, I can just see her life years from now, either following in her mother's footsteps or perhaps dating homeless guys. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Becky Powell, riding in a car with her husband in Richland, Washington, noticed a police officer in foot pursuit of a man who was getting away. "I told my husband, that cop is never going to catch him," she said. So she told her husband to speed up and get in front of the fleeing man. Then she jumped out of the car without even waiting for her husband to stop, getting into a football stance and said, "You're going to stop here." Wow. A pal recounted, "He stiff-armed me and I just wrapped him up and threw him to the ground." She held 20-year-old Joseph Lewis Fry until the officer arrived to make the arrest. Fry ran because he knew that there was a warrant out for his arrest. Now, once he was in handcuffs, Powell whispered in his ear, "How does it feel to be taken down by a mother of 5 and a grandmother of 3? Wow. Powell is only 40. In response, Fry looked grumpy, and a police officer gave her a high five. You know, never underestimate a woman who is able to keep up with toddlers. Just keep that in mind. Always keep that in mind. Anyway, let's get to our next guest, shall we? Dan Melka is the creator of a brand new social media website called PowerTogether.com, an online social network for kids and students that promotes kids and teens to do good deeds for others, and in return they gain points which turn into online currency dollars to buy themselves rewards from companies in and around Canada and the United States. To learn more about this innovative site, Dan Malka joins us on the line right now from right here in Montreal. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Peter.
This is a rather ingenious idea. How did you come up with it, first of all?
Oh, thank you. It's been a long process. We Power Together goes back about 2 years ago, where we were looking into the situation with the bullying and cyberbullying and what's happening in social media. And we're trying to create something that appeals to the youth, something that is cool, something where they'd want to engage. So we've just, you know, been doing our research and studies on the teenagers and preteens and social media and what we can do to try to have them come on board, engage, and doing good things, of course. At the same time, we're looking at I think that the key problem was that kids were being thrown all this new technology at once, and because of this digital era we live in today, there's nothing that was actually prepping them or guiding them into and educating them on becoming socially responsible digital citizens. So we tried to create something that will compile everything into one, but most importantly, creating something that, which is our number one goal, is the privacy, safety of these kids on social media.
Now, the site, which is powertogether.com, is not live yet. And by the way, that the way it's spelled is power, numerical 2, G-E-T-H-E-R.com. When will the site go live?
That's going to go live in a few weeks from now. Just finalizing a few little details, and then we will, I would say, in about 3 weeks, we should be going live.
So how will it work? Do kids have to sign up for this?
Well, what we're doing right now is we're launching our phase one, which is really to inform them of what's about to come out, what we're launching. So they're going to be it's really to start, you know, getting them to signing up and finding out more as to what's happening. And what we're going to be doing is pretty much building a story for the next 8 weeks prior to launching our phase two, which they will be able to create their actual profile and start engaging with the activities we're going to have. So during that 8 weeks, we're going to be launching various webisodes in building a story as to exactly how this is going to work. So by the time we launch our second phase, they're going to be well aware of exactly what this will, what this is all going to be about.
Was there a personal story for you that made you decide this is something you wanted to do?
Usually
there's push that comes to shove when somebody creates something. What was the story behind creating this?
My daughter had gotten bullied a few years back in kindergarten, and when I saw that happening, as a parent, I wanted to know more in terms of how to deal with your child in regards to that. I mean, it wasn't as much of a severe issue compared to what I've seen happen to some other kids, but it doesn't matter. It's still happening, and it's happening at such a young age. And social media makes it worse because of the cyberbullying, where kids feel they can hide behind a screen and feel free to just say whatever they feel like saying. And I saw that as being a problem. So I was just, you know, trying to motivate my child. I motivate my kids all the time, and I want to try to do the same thing for other kids out there through our platform, and at the same time having them do it amongst themselves. So it's a growing problem, and we need to really do something about it now. But it's the way we look at it is, if we want to get these kids on board, we have to create something cool, something that engages them, something that rewards them for doing these things. So this is how it evolved, you know, to this. And I pretty much, and I'll be honest with you, I've sacrificed a lot in doing this. I got rid of whatever I had before. I said my number one priority are my kids. If I had to get rid of my other business, start building this, I said this is my passion.
What was your other business?
This is what I need to do.
What was your other business?
I used to be in cosmetics.
Okay. As I mentioned in the introduction, people will be able to, the kids will be able to use online currency dollars to buy rewards from companies in and around Canada and the United States. I would assume on the back end you've had to approach these companies and discuss this situation with them. How receptive have companies been to this?
Oh, everyone loves the idea. Everyone loves the idea because they see the good behind it. They see the change that it can make by actually getting, you know, these kids performing these tasks and these activities. And it's, you know, it's really, it's going to instill a new culture amongst them and something and sort of bring back that goodness within certain people or things that they haven't known or experienced or weren't taught, but we're going to make it fun. So that by the time they're, and it's funny because we were shooting a video and we had a few kids that were trying to understand what the whole concept is. So once we got them to understand the concept, they're like, oh, this is pretty neat. And then we were just sort of moving from one building to another. And as we're moving, one kid was, we were all in the elevator and one kid actually held the door to hold it for someone else coming in. And one other kid was like, hey, that was a good deed. Well, yes, indeed. We go downstairs, one's opening a door for someone else. So they started doing these things without even realizing it. They're like, hey, this is pretty easy. And it's as simple as that. So you're sort of implanting these things in them that as they grow, now it's going to be a normal thing for them to do, whether it's walk and pick up, see garbage on the floor, pick it up, throw it, or opening doors for people or helping people with their bags. That's what you try to, you know, you want to try to teach them that good side.
As we said earlier, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. You created this because of a situation that was happening in your life. I predict that by the time this goes live and picks up, you're going to have other websites and companies saying, gosh, why didn't we think of this?
Well, yeah, that's always the case. But companies, so like the Cadet, I mean, they want to be a part of something like this because they want to be there to reward the youth for you know, promoting leadership and social responsibility. And that's what we're trying to teach them. And for these companies as well, I mean, it's good on their part as well because they're rewarding the youth as well. You know, by saying, listen, go and do good things and we're going to reward you. It's not as if you're bribing them to do something good. It's you're just offering an incentive. And today the world works around incentives and rewards. And you know how we all are. We all want to go and get something, but we want to have something in return. It's just more to make it a game for them. Let them know that they can go out there and do these things. And there's something there that they have to earn it. It's not as if you're saying, well, listen, do this and you're going to get this incentive right away. You have to earn it. You're going to have to get to a certain level of points to be able to go and redeem for something that you really want. So if you know, if you want an iPhone, and even for parents, this is great because you want that iPhone, no problem. Go on Power Together, earn it, and you'll get it. And that's what it's about.
An excellent idea. And again, that website will go live in a few weeks. It's powertogether.com. That's the word power, numerical 2, GETHER.com. Sounds like a great incentive, a great idea. Dan, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you very much, Pete. I really appreciate it.
Dan Malka, creator of powertogether.com. Their website isn't active yet. It will be up in a couple of weeks. But when it is up and running, you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0266, and you'll find the links. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Every day, 9 people die on American roads because of someone who has been distracted by texting, talking, or emailing on a cell phone. Safety experts have searched for the perfect solution to this problem, but so far, the cell phone apps that have been created and the laws that have been passed are either not widely used or are regularly ignored. The most promising solution is a revolutionary device invented by a former engineer for NASA. It uses new technology to shut down phone use when a car is moving, and many experts believe it's the so-called Holy Grail solution that they've been waiting for. Unfortunately, just when all of the technological hurdles were cleared, an old familiar problem popped up to keep it off the market: lawsuit fears. Let's be fair, this amazing invention could save 3,000 lives a year, but major funders of the device now fear that lawsuits in American courts could put them out of business, so the project is now stalled in its tracks. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses. But recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And still to come on the program, we will talk about dreams. Plus, we will indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way to wrap up the show, as we always do. And we have one more Stuff File news story to share with you here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. A Maryland man who dressed up as a woman to fleece intoxicated passengers for more than $200,000 while driving a taxi in Washington, D.C., pleaded guilty to first-degree felony fraud. 50-year-old Narier Mitchell of Clinton, Michigan, stole PIN numbers and ATM cards from more than 60 people, often focusing on young drinkers, between April 2009 and November of 2013. He was arrested last November wearing a disguise of a woman's wig and padded bra. Mitchell drove a silver Range Rover SUV and focused on picking up passengers near popular bar and nightclub areas in D.C. Mitchell was charged with 5 counts of fraud, with each charge carrying a statutory maximum of 10 years in prison. The plea agreement also calls for him to pay back $228,036 in restitution. Mitchell, that's a lot of taxi driving to pay that back. Mitchell will be held in jail until his sentencing, which is October the 10th. I'm guessing when his fellow inmates realize what he's in for, he'll be very popular in prison. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Dr. Carlisle Smith is a lifetime professor emeritus of psychology at Trent University in Peterborough, Ontario, and the director of the Trent University Sleep Research Laboratories. He's also the author of Heads Up Dreaming: How Your Dreams Can Predict Your Future and Change Your Life. He joins us on the line right now from Peterborough, Ontario. Hi, Carlisle.
Hi.
Thanks for being on the program with us. What exactly is heads-up dreaming?
Example dream that I give is, and this happens to so many people, I find, you have a dream about someone you haven't seen for, years even, maybe someone from high school and so on, and it's unusual enough that you actually kind of remember your dream, and then later in the day, something happens. You actually run into this person, they phone, there's some kind of connection, and it's kind of weird. And you go, oh, my God, I had a dream about this guy. And so that is what I call a heads-up dream. You somehow knew or seemed to know that this was going to be a connection that would be made. And it may not be all that important. It may be, So that happened, but it doesn't maybe change your life too much. It's just something that's kind of interesting, and it goes by. And because it doesn't happen too often, people sort of go, oh, well, maybe I must have been thinking about it. They kind of rationalize it away because you're not supposed to be able to defy time like that. That's what I call a heads-up dream. That's an example of a really simple one.
Do we know why it happens?
We don't know why. I've been watching it go by for about 40 years, first in myself, and then in my family, my friends, all sorts of people can do this. And it's amazing. If I give a talk, about half, maybe a little more than half of the people in the audience will say, oh, yeah, that's happened to me. But then they sort of get shy about it and say, well, I know that's kind of, maybe that's kind of crazy. That's not supposed to happen. Or, there must be some logical explanation that so they don't really feel as if they've actually done anything. But my guess is we can all do this. I think everybody can do this. I've had people who just were like, what? I don't think that's possible. And then they will go home, and the next day they'll phone and they'll say, you know what, I had one of those weird dreams happen to me. And so I think that we all have the ability to do this. It's just that we haven't really focused on it or exploited it very much.
There are some also, some theories on another, what I would guess or call a similar phenomenon, and that is the feeling of deja vu. And I've heard people saying that maybe deja vu is actually dreaming of something that you will experience.
That's right. That's right. And there's a couple of people who actually think that what's happening when you have that experience, that you, like, most people don't remember their dreams very much. And what's happened is that somehow they just have this feeling that they are in something that they actually know how the outcome is going to go. And, of course, there's a movie about this, right? Denzel Washington's done this already. I mean, it's something that everybody talks about. But the part that's missing sometimes is just, oh, yeah, I had a dream about this. They may not remember the dream. And so it's kind of the deja vu, like that. The deja rev might be part of it that's missing. But since a lot of people don't actually remember their dreams when they get up, that part just may be missing, but it's still something that could have been there.
Okay, you study dreams. You've written a book about it called Heads Up Dreaming. How important are dreams?
Well, there are a lot of different ideas about how important dreams are, and they range from mental garbage to really, really important. And I would like to think that the ones that... Now, I find myself that I have about 1 in 10 of my dreams are of the heads-up type. Now, you can use these. This is really a practical thing that you can do. And sometimes what's going to happen isn't apparently that important, but sometimes it's really helpful. And you can make some very important decisions. And you make major decisions in your life, like, you know, getting married, buying a house, buying a car, choosing a job, traveling, maybe going to the other part of the world to do something. Those things you usually make with partial information, right? You never know all the details about what will happen if this, you know, if I buy the house, will I keep my job? You know, there's all sorts of things that you can, you know, think about that you don't know. It just reduces the uncertainty in your life if you have one of these dreams and you have the nerve to follow it through. For example, if you're a professor at a university and you're trying to keep a lab like mine up, you have to apply for grants. And it's a tough business. Not everybody gets them, like not very many get them at all. So when you apply in the fall, and then you have to wait until next spring late before you actually know whether you got any money or not. And one year, for example, I dreamt that I had gotten the money. Now, you might think that's a 50-50 thing, but it's not. It's like 1 in 17, when, you know, it's really, really 1 in 17 or something like that. It's not as likely that you'll get it as you think. So I dreamt that I had gotten it. And there was this kid came around, and he was really, really a good student. And I decided, if I don't take him, he's going to get another job. He's going to go somewhere else. There's only a certain number of really good students around. So I decided that I would say, yeah, I'll hire you. I've got money, even though I didn't at that point know whether I had money. And it wasn't until months later that I found out that I did have the money, and that was quite a rush. But it was a way of sort of having a leg up, and I could have said no, I don't know for sure, so I'm just going to have to say no, and you know he would have gone away and done something else. But as it turned out, I played it differently, and I got to keep him as a student, and it all worked out quite well.
So you're saying then that we should listen to our dreams.
Oh yeah, now I think that. In doing this, you have to do a little practicing. I mean, I didn't do that. That wasn't my first dream. I had been watching this go by for a few years, and so I kind of had an idea about which ones looked like the kind of dreams that would actually be accurate. and which ones, no, didn't have anything to do with that kind of thing. So I did have a feel for that, and I think that if you're going to make really big decisions, having just heard this, you should actually practice a little bit and have at least see a few of these, you know, kind of not so important heads-up beams go by, so you at least know what they look like.
Another theory I've also heard is that sometimes dreams are like or have the same effect on people that in some cases getting drunk does. And by that I mean it removes a filter that allows your subconscious to come through. In other words, truth comes out in dreams whether you like it or not. Is that true?
Well, yeah, and that's one model. I would say that dreams do provide you with a perspective that is more true than the one you hold when you are awake. And it often knocks you over the head. It tends to be, in my case anyway, for example, I used to smoke 65 cigarettes a day. And that's a lot of cigarettes if you are a smoker, or even if you're not. And I didn't think anything of it. I was young. And then one night I had this dream where I was crossing a little bridge. It was made out of logs. And as I started across, the logs, the heads of the logs turned into snakes, and they were poison, and they bit me, and I felt this poison going through my body. And it turned out that these things were, the little logs were Rothman's cigarettes. And I managed to quit smoking, and that dream was sort of just always there in the background. I woke up really being happy that it was just a dream, but that it didn't end there. I mean, I managed to quit smoking because of that, and I'm really happy that I did.
The book is called Heads Up Dreaming, How Your Dreams Can Predict Your Future and Change Your Life. I've just got one more quick question to ask, and that is, I know some people think it's a good idea that they should keep a pad and paper by their bed, quickly jot down dreams when they wake up. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yes. Some people seem to be really good at remembering their dreams. But if you're going to do this, you also got to write them down and date them so that later on you can't sort of just change your memory of the dream to sort of fit what happened in the daytime and so on. You have to write them down. I tell you what I do. In the complete darkness, I have a clipboard and blank paper and a pen that is actually tied on so that I can find it without, I just lift up the clipboard in the dark. And I write down the key sentences in the complete darkness. If I turn on the light, it's gone. If I try to do some kind of taping, it's gone. I mean, the more you move around, the less likely you are to remember. So that's what I do. And in the morning, I look at this really bad writing, but it's enough to give me the trigger to get back to my dream. And that's how I do it. And I've tried a lot of different things. I say some people find this really easy to do. I have people who remember, you know, three dreams a night, and there's people who haven't had a dream in 10 years. And there's just this wide difference. But you can train yourself to get better at it. You just practice. It's practice.
Dr. Carlisle, thank you very, very much, Dr. Smith, for being on the program with us.
Absolutely.
Dr. Carlisle Smith, author of Heads Up Dreaming, How Your Dreams Can Predict Your Future and Change Your Life. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0266, and you'll find the links to his website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A Michigan man who admitted throwing a drug-filled football over a prison fence was immature was sentenced to prison. Kristen Dion Sterling Moore, who was 22, apologized in Jackson County Circuit Judge Susan Beebe's courtroom for throwing a football containing marijuana, suspected heroin, and three cell phones over a fence at the G. Robert Cotton Correctional Facility in June. Authorities say Moore's package failed to reach prisoners as it only made it over one of the facility's two fences. Moore, who was under probation at the time of the offense for a 2012 home invasion charge, told the court that it was a thoughtless and immature decision to attempt to throw the contraband-filled football into the facility. Moore was sentenced to 17 to 60 months in prison for two counts of furnishing contraband to a prisoner. Now why, oh why, would someone think that they would be able to throw a football filled with contraband for distance over not one but two prison fences, and never mind being successful with the ploy, but even if they were, successfully get away with it? Well, one reason, and one reason only, they're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0266. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0266. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.